This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina is one of the few states in the country where owning a handgun puts you in the public record. Now, advocates say that ensures gun permits are issued responsibly, but Republicans in the House and Senate want to remove public access to gun permits. On today's program, we'll talk about the tension between freedom of the press and the right to bear arms. Later, we'll talk about the proposal that Wake County hopes will make our schools safer. Plus, we'll look at the continued transformation of the Racial Justice Act. With us for our Week in Review is Gurnell Scott. He's Assistant News Director for WUNC. Carl Kenny is a columnist, novelist, and pastor in Durham. And Michael Gillespie is a professor of philosophy and political science at Duke University. Welcome to all of you. It's great to have you on the program.
It's good to see you, Frank. Being here.
Gurnell, let's talk about the struggle over access to gun permit. First of all, how did this discussion get started in North Carolina?
Well, it was kind of a national discussion that started after Sandy Hook, and that is sort of where all the gun discussion has started. Once that tragedy in Sandy Hook happened, there have been reports and in newspapers up in the Northeast where they put in databases where you could search, where you could find people who had gun permits. They put it out there for everyone to see. And North Carolina is, as you mentioned, one of 12 states where if you own a gun, it's public record. To flesh that out throughout the 50 states, there are 10 other states that have limited access and 28 states that don't allow you access to those records. Well, advocates for a bill that has been filed to make those records private say, okay, if those records remain public, then basically the gun owners, the people who get those permits, the people who have those permits, then become targets because of this backlash against gun owners. They are subject to thefts. They are subject to break-ins, people who want to make their point by some kind of possible violence against them. And that is why these folks are hot and heavy about wanting to take that out of the public record.
And this all got started, the idea that when these records are public, they might be publicized.
Right.
Really get started in this state, I think, with a conflict now between Grassroots North Carolina and WRAL. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, basically, Mark Binker, one of the reporters who does a lot of internet work for WRAL, basically did something like almost what was happening in after Sandy Hook, where there was a searchable database that they put and gave everyone access to that allow people to find out who these permit owners are. And the Grassroots North Carolina said, no, we can't have that. And that, again, is going to lead to that backlash against these permit owners. And it has escalated from there into a full-scale debate that has reached the halls of the legislature.
Michael Gillespie, let's talk about it. I mean, here's the way it was used and why there's a controversy. The fact that we're going to put it on the internet, have a map with pins in it, and show you your neighbors with guns, maybe there's a backlash. That's not the theory of the law, though. I mean, why do we say that if you're going to register your gun in public and with a public agency like the sheriff's office, then the public needs to know about that? What would be the theory behind that?
Well, I think the theory behind—I mean, there really are two conflicts here, one between the First and Second Amendment, between the right of free speech and right of the freedom of the press and the right to bear arms. And there's a kind of subliminal argument there about a right that a lot of conservatives don't think exists, which is to say a right to privacy. At least when it comes to abortion, this is something that conservatives have typically argued really does not exist. And yet in this case, it is a kind of argument for the necessity of privacy on these matters. And you know, there's some telling reason to have this. I mean, if you think about all the other things that the government knows about us, we really don't want those publicized as well, our medical records and whether or not we're watching pornography on the internet. All of those kinds of things. So I think there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, but I think this is really a conflict of rights, and it's something that really needs to be resolved.
But we don't register our pornographic habits with the government, and there's not an agency like a sheriff's department. It seems to me that there's also a level of accountability inherent in this. For instance, if you're the sheriff's department and you register people who can have a gun, there are people who can't have a gun, like felons. If I don't know who is and who isn't on that registry, you could open a little business on the side, not that any sheriff in North Carolina would do that, but you could open a business selling registrations to unlawful or unqualified and gun owners, and I wouldn't know about it because it's a secret. I mean, that seems to me an accountability issue.
Sure, but I just don't think the data, you know, if you look at the differences between the states that do and do not allow public access to these records, I don't think there's any evidence that disallowing public access is really increasing illegal gun ownership. Illegal gun ownership takes place, you know, outside of the whole system of laws. There are very few people that illegally register their weapons, right? They can simply own the weapons and hold on to them in any case.
All right, Carl, Kenny, what do you think about this?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we have this conflict between these two amendments that we, you know, we lift up in public discourse as being core to our value systems. They're in conflict with one another, and as a journalist, you know, I think that we hold responsibility as journalists not to present what we know in a way that brings danger to those who are innocent. Could be innocent victims to the dispensing of that information. There's a difference between law and ethics. And I think whenever we begin having a conversation about limiting our amendment rights, and of course in this case a First Amendment right, to list that which is part of public information, I think it's danger whenever we go that route. But for the press, we have a higher obligation, in other words, not to pull the trigger. You know, the trigger would be the dispense of information that could be dangerous to people like my father, who's a gun owner, who's 74 years old and who's afraid that someone will break into his home and take his guns. So we have to protect him from the potential of that taking place. So the press has an obligation to say no.
Do we know in these other states, and we may not, it may not be part of the discourse, whether or not anybody would have access in those other states? In other words, if accountability were the issue, would a court, would some other body have the right to look at these, but perhaps not the press? And again, with some limits about what you could and couldn't publicize, medical records is another. I mean, certainly it can come up in a court case, but we don't want them all over the internet. Do we know what kind of limited access other government agencies have in those states where press access is prohibited?
It's not totally clear. Again, like we said, the 10 states that have that limited access, how far they can go, what they can find out, what they can disseminate. It's a little unclear as to what can be done, what can't be done, what can be said, what can't be said. But we do know that those are the limited access in those states.
Is the tension here, Michael, between the right to privacy and the public's right to know what's on the public record? Or, I mean, is there any limit to it? It seems to me that nothing about this inherently suppresses gun ownership.
Well, no. You know, that goes back to the whole interpretation of the Second Amendment that really, you know, has taken place over the years. You know, originally it's fairly clear that Congress, you know, in the first instance imagined that this amendment would only apply to the federal government. It didn't apply to state controls. But even then it was only justified in terms of maintaining a militia and not individuals. But, you know, since the Civil War and incorporation of the amendments into state constitutions as well, we've come to believe, and interpretation by the court, that this is a right to autonomy and to the ownership of guns by individuals for their own protection. You know, we've come to take that pretty much for granted. You know, there are a lot. It's a hot button issue, obviously, because of violence and gun violence in the United States. But it's something. You know, it seems to me that in the long run, is so well protected by the Constitution and by the Supreme Court that any real effective changes are not likely to take place. And in that sense, I sort of wish we would focus on areas in which there could be agreement between the different sides. For example, I'm sure that Carl's father keeps his gun sort of safely locked away from children, for example. So we might think about requiring gun manufacturers to sell all of their weapons with trigger locks, for example, just as a way of keeping people safe. And I think this whole dispute over these kind of issues is really a kind of faux dispute, because it really isn't about these issues. It's really about whether we should have guns or not, and I think that's something we're just not going to settle.
But they
now
do get fought over these proxy issues, and it does seem that the gun industry looks at any kind of restriction at all as somehow an impediment to gun ownership.
Yeah, you know, the question for me is I read the Second Amendment where it talks about a well-regulated militia. The question for me is when did that become a well-regulated militia that purchases guns in an unregulated fashion? You know, if the Constitution wants to regulate or to organize those who own guns. Where did the translation of that shift to giving people the right not to be regulated?
Yeah, and I think that's what you were saying, Michael, is that there is a provision in there for regulation. It's not just having the gun under any circumstances. And now that's getting more and more difficult because gun locks become a hot button issue. And somehow it's like you're taking our right to own a gun. No, we just had a 4-year-old shot in Apex just this week, went to his car in his driveway in Apex, pulled out a gun, shot himself in the leg. So I guess there's some sense that regulation of some sort may be in the news for quite some time to come. We'll talk about school safety and what to do because all those guns are out there. Now the Wake County Schools has to spend $18 million, it thinks, to make our schools safer. We'll talk about that and much, much more as our conversation on the state of things with Grinnell Scott, Assistant News Director at WUNC, Carl Kenny, columnist, novelist, and pastor in Durham, and Michael Gillespie, a professor of philosophy and political science at Duke, continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, looking back at the week in review, talking with Grinnell Scott, Assistant News Director for WUNC, Carl Kenny, a writer and pastor in Durham, Michael Gillespie, a professor of philosophy and political science at Duke. Grinnell, let's talk about school safety now. We're talking about gun violence, and certainly in light of the recent Sandy Hook shooting, schools across the country now engaged in finding ways that they can ensure greater safety in their schools. Wake County now has a proposal to spend another $18 million on security. Tell us about that proposal.
It's been almost 40 years since I've been in elementary school. And I remember back then, and my parents have told me, they would openly invite parents to come in and see what your kids are doing and that kind of thing. Well, apparently no more because of Sandy Hook. This is another national conversation that has sparked from that. Wake County and other school districts are trying to figure out how can we protect students. And Wake County is considering spending just a little over $18 million, as you said, to try and do what they can to make schools a little less accessible to just anyone. And as part of that $18 million, we're looking at almost $12 million for surveillance cameras, almost $4 million for an automatic locking system in schools, about $600,000 to $700,000 for a buzzer system where people can buzz in so they can be checked out. I mean, we're looking at those kinds of things. Some people may say you're turning your school into an armed camp and you don't have access. And maybe that's why PTAs aren't, a lot of people aren't participating because, you know, it's being a little less inclusive of all these parents.
Well, but not an armed camp because one of the things that we'll talk about that in a second, because other schools have suggested that armed guards be placed in these schools, not Wake County. That's not part of their proposal.
That's not part of their proposal. They wanted to put in these technological things to try and keep the bad elements out of schools.
So, you know, interesting because Sheriff Harrison testified at a hearing and said, look, this is a nightmare because schools really weren't designed to be locked down this way. And especially in Wake County, you've got kids out in trailers. There's so many buildings outside the main building, a main building never designed as a secure institution to begin with. It's going to be a tricky process to get all those things secure and locked down.
And it is a very hot button debate now because people don't want these schools to be cut off.
Carl, Kenny, what do you think about this proposal at the Wake County Schools?
You know, it's troubling. It's troubling that we have to have this conversation. But I think that so much of it is just a knee-jerk reaction that has been taking place across our country. And my primary concern is that we're beginning to think about spending money that could be earmarked for educating young people. And I'm not so sure that it will make a difference to spend that kind of money on security when there is really, really no way that you can stop a mad person from entering into an institution like a school and doing what they're going to do.
No,
I just don't think it's going to stop anything.
Or a kid from getting the gun from the car in their driveway and taking it to school rather than shoot yourself in the leg, which happens. So, I mean, it does seem to me a kind of a baffling problem. But Michael Gillespie, you've talked and thought about this too. The idea that when these big, you know, headline issues and stories break, we focus our attention and begin to solve problems that may not even be there in terms of a serious problem.
Well, I think it really skews our ability to estimate risk. And just if you just look very carefully at a few data, I think you see why this is such a bad idea. Over the last 33 years, on average, about 9 or 10 kids have been killed per year in schools. If you look at other sources of youth death, 2,800 per year die of gun violence outside of schools, not in the schools. 1,500 are killed through child abuse, and 8,000 die in automobile accidents. So that we're talking about just a tiny, tiny number of people. And this expense of $18 million, you know, you're essentially taking for a year's worth of 180 police off the street or 360 teachers out of the schools. So it's a tremendous expense for very, very little return. I calculated at one point that you'd probably save one life in this way, if you were 100% effective with security measures, it would cost $1.8 billion. So think about what else we can spend that money on that will save lives and will make our children safer. But I understand that parents are very concerned. But again, it has to do with our misestimation of risk that comes about because of the fact that these things seem so close to us when we see them on television every day.
And the everyday part of it is important. It is every day. It is the headline. It is over and over again. And it's hard not to imagine it's going to happen to you. It's how humans work, right? You identify mm-hmm. with it. And Carl, all of these other causes of death are equally preventable. There are things you can do to prevent the deaths on the streets from violence and abuse and all the other things.
Yeah, we can have another conversation about gun control in inner city communities. We can talk about drunk driving. I mean, there are other conversations that we shouldn't spend all of our attention on one issue like this when there's so many others. That's not to minimize the importance of it, but. $18 million is a lot of money.
Well, and that's the thing. It's also part of a much larger picture, and it never gets seen or even spoken of within that context. So all of that said, Gernal, I don't see any board members here at this table, so maybe that part of the conversation will get to them. What's the likelihood that this is going to go through and be part of the...
I don't know how much that's going to go through. There is a definite... political divide on the school board. It's hard to say how many school board members will actually go for this proposal. $18.1 million is a lot of money, and to put these technological advances in school. I mean, they've already had a debate about spending money to put armed officers in school, as we mentioned, and that really didn't seem to go anywhere, although there are school districts around the country that are trying to find ways to get officers in schools. I saw one story on the national networks about Simpsonville, South Carolina. There's a school that allows officers to establish their community service offices in schools. All the school needs to do is provide them a desk and Wi-Fi. They can do their work from the school, and they are an officer. They can patrol the halls on their off time, and it doesn't cost the school district a single dime.
But they're armed, and so that does bring a gun into
that's
the school.
That's true. There is that. I mean, there is that part of the discussion that needs to be had.
Well, let me take one step back before we leave this, Michael, and just talk a little bit about how difficult it would be. What if you're the member of that board who wants to do what you just said and say, hey, folks, let's step back. Let's take a look at the big picture. Talk about some of the things that Carl mentioned. You can't do it politically. That's suicide, right? Because you're saying, let's not protect our children. Let's be less safe. Let's be a little more reckless with our kids. I mean, that's how you can't possibly be that guy and survive the next election, right?
Well, you know, I think that certainly if the media were to help out a little bit and make clear to people certain facts, like simply that schools are the safest place for kids to be, much safer than being at home, much safer than being on the streets, and that if we really want to protect our kids, there are a lot of other things that we can do that will do a better job at that. You know, I think that that's not impossible to sell. And I think at some point politicians have to be, even in democratic societies, have to be leaders and not just followers of public opinion. They have to educate public opinion. And I think, you know, a show like yours can help do that by making clear to people just how safe schools actually are compared to any place else that our children are.
Here's what's wrong with a show like this, among other things. We know that people make their opinion, they come up with opinion first and then go look for the facts that validate the opinion. I mean, there's plenty of research to show we just don't operate the way we think we'd like to, which is to go find the facts and then make an opinion, make a decision.
Well, but I think if – I'll go back to something Carl said earlier. If journalists are responsible in the first place, and make clear that these things are not immediately dangerous to all of us, whether they're terrorism or flying in airplanes. People have vastly overestimated the risk of all of these things. And that's a really a long-term public education project that journalism has to take part in, that education has to be a part of. And, you know, it runs against our basic natures because we as the kinds of beings we are probably designed to live in groups of 100 people. And we can understand those groups. And as soon as we're surrounded by strangers, as soon as things seem to be much larger and beyond our ken, we really fall back upon our sort of innate emotional responses to those things. So, you know, I think this is a long-term project. We're not going to solve it today, but I would hope that some of those people in Raleigh would and Wake County would do their very best to convince their constituents that there are lots of better things they can spend their money on.
And that would be the other side of it, Carl, maybe talking first about the actual danger and using some facts to deliver. But the other thing is all of the other problems that we could focus on that bear on this. We've got a school-to-prison pipeline, discipline policies that are as well as tracking policies, academic tracking policies that have been clearly shown to disadvantage people of color in the school system. And swell our prison population leads to more violence on the street, more dropout, and you know, to try to get attention for those problems so that they could be taken seriously and receive $18 million worth of attention is a tough sell.
Well, you know, not to pick on Wake County, but they've got other issues that they need to address after the dismantling of the school board over the past couple of years. There are other critical issues that they need to discuss fix some of the woes within their busing system and, you know, their attempt to resegregate their education system. There are other important issues that need to be addressed. Although this isn't important, student safety is incredibly important, and we don't want to make light of the fact that people are hurting, parents are hurting, they're afraid. People are running away from public education and finding alternatives because they don't feel safe. I get all of that. I'm a parent. My kids went through that process. I understand it, but there are other issues like achievement gap and dealing with the Hispanic population and how that impacts. They're impacted by a lack of support within education system that need to also be addressed.
Yeah, Michael? Just to give you one example, about 66% of the people that are in prisons have learning disabilities, right? Imagine that we had spent that $18 million dealing with learning disabilities in kids in Wake County schools. Mm. How much would that reduce our future prison populations? I think those are the kinds of things we have to take account of.
Let's shift gears a little bit, talk about the Racial Justice Act. It was, according to the supporters of the Racial Justice Act initially, they would say it was gutted in the last section, the last session of the legislature, and now it is threatened with extinction. Let's talk about where the Racial Justice Act is now in the legislature, Gernot.
That's right. 2009, the Racial Justice Act was passed, and advocates like the NAACP and others basically said it was a victory for people who thought that bias played a role in their sentences to death. And of course, we all know now that it's been, I believe, 2007 since anyone was executed in North Carolina, or it's been about that long. And now Tom Goolsbee, a senator from Wilmington, wants to or has put forth a bill that would basically wipe that off the books. He says it's time to kickstart the death penalty in North Carolina again, bring closure to victims' families in this case, and try to allow these cases to move forward through the what it was intended for them to do. Right. And now he's got the support of prosecutors behind him, and it has sparked that debate.
Well, interestingly enough, he used the word not closure but justice. He said it's time to bring justice. And, of course, those cases that have come before judges under the Racial Justice Act, which allows only those death penalties. So if you have a death sentence, you can then make a case, if you can, that race played a part not in your conviction but in your sentencing. And in a couple of cases, judges agreed that this has to be reviewed because it does seem clear. So then the question of justice, whether you have the right person or whether justice was done, is part of the question. What do you think? Do we still need the Racial Justice Act?
Well, you look at Judge George Weeks' decision to commute the sentence of Marcus Robinson. And in that particular case, it has been proven that the prosecutor, by prosecution, manipulated the process by not choosing African Americans to serve on the jury. And there are a number of cases where race was a factor in determining guilt. The Racial Justice Act is in place to protect individuals who are punished to death when there is clear bias based on race. It is not an act that limits the possibility for the death penalty. It is only a protection for those who are engaged in a process that is clearly stacked against people of color. And we look at the Daryl Hunt case, and we have another example of how race was used as a determinant on the side of the prosecution, not to use everything at the disposal to prevent what happened in the miscarriage of justice. Without the Racial Justice Act, there is no way to maintain the balance in a very unbalanced system. So it is definitely necessary to keep it.
And just to be very clear, and I want to hear from you, Michael, of course, in the case of Daryl Hunt, he was actually innocent. In the Racial Justice Act doesn't go to the question of innocence. And in fact, the only thing that can happen if you find race was involved in your sentencing is that it'll be commuted to a life sentence. So you won't get out of jail. I would just want to make that clear in the act itself. Do we need it, Michael Gillespie?
Well, you know, I'll play the devil's advocate for just a second. Even liberals who look at death penalty as a public policy, you know, have been surprised by a lot of recent research that seems to show that every time you put somebody to death, you probably prevent 17 different murders. Now, on the other hand, we know that about half the people that are put to death are probably put to death wrongly, right? So, you know, we're caught in this kind of bind. There's a general sense that a death penalty is an ultimate penalty that will deter violent crime in a whole variety of ways. On the other hand, we're clearly not doing a very good job in picking out the people that we should be putting to death. And in fact, we know that among those people that are put to death, there's overwhelming numbers of African Americans who fall into that category. Now, whether the Racial Justice Act will be successful in preventing that is a little bit hard to know, right? I think there are all kinds of ways in which African Americans have this system stacked against them, from the differences in legal penalties for cocaine possession versus crack possession, to the absence of resources to hire legal counsel, to profiling that takes place. So, you know, I'm not sure that I would think that the Racial Justice Act is going to solve those problems. I think, you know, money put into innocence projects such as that run at Duke Law School and other places sometimes are more effective because – and in the long run may actually be more effective in not only reducing the number of death penalty cases but in reducing the sentences of people that are already in jail. So, you know, I think that this is a political fight that probably isn't worth fighting. I'd rather fight for the same ends, but in different ways.
What about that, Carl?
Well, it's a good point. The concern for me is that you got to give a person time to figure out whether or not they're innocent or not. There are a number of cases over the past few years with DNA testing has been used to determine the innocence of those who were on death row. My concern is that one life lost in the process of waiting would be a shameful conclusion.
And again, you know, just getting back to just to make sure we're clear on the distinction, we don't have to prove innocence in this, but we do have to show that race was a factor in your sentence, that if you had been a white man, it's likely you would have gotten life in prison and not death. So when you get back to Senator Goolsbee's assertion that justice will be done if we finally get these executions underway, if you're sentenced under an unjust process, is that accurate? I mean, I think that is a fundamental question that only the Racial Justice Act itself addresses, and really no other legislation in the country is like this.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. Assume for the moment that everyone that was convicted of murder was guilty, right, and that we weren't making mistakes. And then assume that we believe that the death penalty is a legitimate penalty for those kinds of crimes, then probably we'd want to put as many people to death as we could, right? Under that circumstances, we should be having a Racial Justice Act that made sure that more white people were being put to death under the death penalty. Right. You know, we don't do that. And so I think it really is not an issue about the law. about justice being done. It's an issue about the equality in justice, and that's covered under the 14th Amendment. I mean, where everybody's supposed to be treated equally under the laws.
Right.
So I think this is not a it isn't about justice being done. It really is a case about the equality of justice being delivered to everybody, regardless of their race, color, creed, or place of national origin.
I wish we had more time, but we don't. I want to thank you all for being on the program today. Michael Gillespie, professor of philosophy and political science at Duke. Carl Kenny, columnist, novelist, and pastor in Durham. Grinnell Scott is assistant news director at WUNC. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Got live music coming up. The Gravy Boys are next. Stay tuned.